Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jen Cates from the Kaiser Family Foundation, and please eat. We scarf down our food, so we're ready to go. I will echo what others have said and thank CSIS, in particular Steve Morrison, Elisa Carty, and Janet Fleischman for pulling this together and inviting all of us here. But I also want to give a shout out to Janet specifically because she's made this particular issue she's put it forward for several years, and I think it's helped really move policy forward both at PEPFAR and generally in raising this issue of the issue of integration and linkages. So thanks, Janet, for helping to bring us to this point. And I'm honored to be able to be here and moderate this panel because I do remember a time, particularly early on in PEPFAR 1, when the idea of integration was not one that was well accepted. In the very beginning, the sort of general sense of PEPFAR was we're doing HIV, and that meant HIV as opposed to any other kinds of service categories. And that changed over time, but I think where we are today is that we all generally accept the idea of integration and linkages and wraparound services. It's a supported idea clearly at the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator at the State Department and in U.S. policy, but less accessible to all of us and less easy to talk about are actual real examples. So we talk about the ideas, but we don't always get a chance to hear from experts in the field about real examples and what they are doing, the challenges they face, how it is working, and what needs to happen going forward. So today I think we're really excited and lucky to have three people who are going to speak about field experience with PEPFAR and wraparound services of family planning, education, HIV, et cetera, bringing those all together in concrete examples. So I will briefly tell you who we're here from in the order and let them go in that order, and then we'll do the same thing, take questions. So first we're going to hear a perspective from Zambia, from Daphne Chimuka, who is the National Coordinator for the Forum for African Women Educationalists of Zambia, where she's been for more than a decade. Then we'll hear from Dr. Bradford Strickland, also from a Zambia perspective, from the American Institutes of Research and the International Development Division. And then last, we'll hear from Dr. Martin Solomon, who's the regional medical advisor of FHI based in Kenya. So we'll hear the Kenya perspective. And I will say I got to see the presentations ahead of time, so they're very interesting and formative. And one of the slides that stuck out to me as a sort of guiding principle for all of us here is the concept of divided, we will fail. So I'm thinking about integration and linkages. Happy to introduce you to go first.
Good afternoon. I would like to echo my colleagues who came here before me and thank CSI, in particular Janet, for allowing us to be here and to share our experiences. I come from an organization which is a regional network of women that are working to address issues of gender in education on the African continent. And I would like to start by restating Professor Kelly's words. Professor Kelly is a renowned HIV/AIDS activist and an academician who said the war against AIDS will be won when it is won among the youth. And I wish to add that it will be won when it is won amongst the girls. The reason for this is that HIV/AIDS in our country in particular is located in the sphere of the youth. We have an HIV prevalence of 14.3% amongst the 15 to 49 years. And this age group includes adolescents who are in our schools, in both basic and high schools, and who are becoming sexually active. But most of them do not have the opportunities to learn how to manage their sexuality. And they venture into sex without any guidance. The other reason why we are concerned is that owing to gender inequalities, girls and women are indirectly or directly more at risk. The current situation is that of that 14.3 prevalence, 16% accounts for women and only 12% men and boys infected. Then we are also concerned because the schoolgirl pregnancy rates in Zambia are very high. And this, of course, is due to, first of all, the value that is placed in being a mother, and also the violence against girls that has resulted in many of them carrying unwanted pregnancy. In 2007, for instance, we lost 13,133 girls to pregnancy. And though we have the reentry policy, which allows these girls to come back after pregnancy, after delivery, only that number came back. And that number is not from that, is not all from the 13,000 that left in that particular year. These comprises of girls that had dropped out the year before or 2 years earlier, because the policy does not restrict a person to re-enter within that year. So within from that cohort, perhaps it's only one third that managed to go back to school. And then the other concern is that we have very high maternal mortality. The 2007 Ministry of Health report indicated that we lose 449 women in every 1,000 births. Oh my goodness, what has happened? Okay. Now, the Ministry of Education has tried to address within the sector, address the issue of HIV/AIDS as it affects girls' education. However, there are a number of challenges that the ministry has. One of them is the low commitment and lack of mechanism to manage violence against girls as it happens in the school sector. The second one is we have an obligation to meet certain international commitments, and one of them is the education for all. But at the moment, the priority for the Ministry of Education is to expand access. And this is at it leaves very little money to be spent on quality consideration. And issues of addressing the curriculum as it affects girls' education, and issues of integrating HIV/AIDS in the curriculum, they all border on quality consideration, which the government has not put much money to. Then also the failure to domesticate human rights protocols, and the fact that our country has a dual legal system has had a very negative impact on girls' education. One example I can give you is that while the formal law does criminalize sex with a child, a girl who is below 16, the customary law allows a child, a parent, to marry off a child at puberty. So if puberty happens at 10 years, that child can be given into marriage. Then we also have a problem of low human resource capacity to mainstream gender and HIV/AIDS. These concepts are both new in our countries. HIV/AIDS is a new phenomenon. But there hasn't been a deliberate effort to train people on not just the medical side of HIV/AIDS, but the social sides, the economic impact of HIV/AIDS. Then gender inequalities, as I said, in the education opportunities and allocation has also been a challenge. And policies that have negatively impacted on girls' education. One of the policies is the deboarding policy. Government, in its wisdom, decided that there is more to be gained by expanding access, by doing away with boarding schools so that more and more children can access education, because boarding schools are expensive to manage. But what has happened is that there has not been a concurrent program to build schools nearer to the children or to their homes. So when a child is accepted to a boarding school, to a day school, which is located very far from home, they have to leave their family homes to go and live near the school. And most of them will live alone in rented accommodation, all in some makeshift weekly boarding arrangements. Then also the weak adolescent sexual and reproductive health curriculum and its execution. These have been challenges. And the ineffective implementation of the reentry policy, because the reentry policy is very clear about what steps schools need to take to get a child that has been seen to be pregnant up to the and track her up to the time she comes back to school. But this hasn't been happening. Now, the response of the Ministry of Education has been in four areas. The first one has been prevention. And for this one, the ministry has integrated HIV/AIDS and life skills information in the basic and high school curriculum. But it has also allowed, the ministry has allowed a number of NGOs to go into those schools and carry out adolescent sexual reproductive projects. Now, the challenge here is that there is no common curriculum that these organizations follow. So there are a lot of mixed messages that are given when these organizations go there. Then the policy against, there's also a Ministry of Education policy against sex education in schools. We can teach in biology what constitutes a man and a woman, but you can't go into details and teach sex education to children who are below 14 years. Then there's also a policy against condom distribution. So we teach about ABC, but you cannot take condoms into schools. So what you just do is tell them, yes, this condom works, you can go and get it from a shop. And most of them do not have the money to buy those condoms. We've had instances where some children are even using ordinary plastics as a replacement for condoms, which, of course, are not effective. Then the second approach has been care and support. And mainly, the government has been distributing bursaries to support orphans and priorities given to AIDS orphans. Then there's also an ART program for those that are HIV positive. But the challenge has been that the bursary packages are insufficient and sometimes not comprehensive. Sometimes the government would, in a school, provide funds for tuition, but a child that comes from 40 kilometers and is in a boarding school or in a weekly boarding, without funds to allow that child to move from the family home to go to school, even if the money is available, she would still not go to school. Then there is no policy on OVC in education. We have been advocating for this policy for a long time. It hasn't come into fruition yet. Then the absence of structured counseling and nutritional support for HIV positive has also been a gap. We have a number of NGOs that have been providing home-based care, but that is not adequate. Then HIV/AIDS in workplaces. Again, here we see a lack of prioritized funding for comprehensive and mainstreamed HIV/AIDS programs, and also planning and management. The gap there has been lack of coordination mechanisms for intersector and intrasector planning and implementation. Now, that is just a bit about our organization, and I would like to draw your attention to our mission, which is what got us involved in HIV/AIDS work. We are essentially an advocacy NGO, but we use these demonstrative interventions, like the work that we do in the HIV, to provide lessons that we can then use to advocate for policies that can protect girls' education. Now, what we did with the partnership between ourselves and AIR and Changes through the PEPFAR funds, we had an integrated support package. The first one was the issue that we were addressing, which came out of a study that we did after implementing the Changes One program, that due to discrimination against girls, they are usually the first choice for removal from school when incomes dwindle. And for that, we introduced a full scholarship package. And this looked at not just the tuition fees, but all other education-related costs. The second issue was lack of sanitary wear. And many families that live in poverty, for them, sanitary pads are a luxury. And what they would normally do is stay away from school during menstruation. And while they are away, school does not stop. It continues, so they would often end up with poor performance. Then the next one was we started providing sanitary wear. In fact, we went into a partnership with an organization, an American organization called the Once a Month Campaign, and we were receiving these sanitary, the disposable pads. But again, the problem was the environmental issues. In some schools, there are no sanitary disposal facilities. So now we have gone into an innovation where we are making reusable pads, which are given to the girls, and they use them to ensure that they are in school, even during menstruation. The third issue was distance to school, which I mentioned, that because there are not enough boarding schools, there are children that have to move to go and live near the school. And on my right there, you see a some kind of structure where those girls live. And this, of course, exposes them to all kinds of danger. There are some that have been raped in the middle of the night. And in a place like this, there's no electricity. The girls don't even know who did such acts to them. So we went into the safety and security program. We had a friend in the embassy, Ambassador Brennan, who gave us the first a grant that gave us that we used to build girls' hostels. To date, we have constructed 6 hostels, 3 of them with the funding that we got through Ambassador Brennan. Then we also have safe houses located in those places where girls are most at risk. Then the next issue was that most girls endure abuse in silence. You know, we come from a culture where girls are taught to endure, you know, not to assert themselves. They are raised to be obedient. And most of them would drop out of school because they are given up. They are given into marriage, or they are used for dangerous sexual practices like sexual cleansing. When a relative dies, a girl could be used to cleanse the surviving spouse, and that has had an impact on the HIV/AIDS.
This is your 1-minute warning.
Right, thank you. So those are some of the things that we did. We started a mentoring program, which is the Students Alliance for Female Education clubs. These are a peer support mechanism where boys and girls meet together. And the aim really is to cultivate positive gender relations so that boys can begin to respect girls' rights, and girls in turn can also begin to respect boys' rights. Then the next one was we did a lot of community advocacy to address the cultural and traditional practices that were constraining girls' education. Now, here is just an example of what we are saying, that education alone is not enough. We need to empower women so that they are able to make choices and also take certain decisions, painful as they may be. Now, that here is just an argument on what is the cost of neglecting girls' education in the context of HIV/AIDS. Sorry, I'm running. Not able to go through that. What needs to be done? We need to revisit our curriculum as the first step. We need to have an age-appropriate adolescent and sexual reproductive health that will provide a wide range of opportunities, first of all for self-development and also for solidarity building. Some of these children come from homes where there are no parents anymore. They are child-headed homes, and they need this solidarity for them to learn the basics in life. Government, through the Ministry of Education, has to spearhead the development of coordination and referral mechanisms so that we are able to address all the issues as comprehensively. USAID, we would suggest that USAID works with the Ministry of Education to establish monitoring systems to track the impact of HIV/AIDS programs on girls' education, and also to support innovations that reduce girls' vulnerability to AIDS as integrated support packages. Then as non-state actors, we need to create an atmosphere in schools where communities are able to come in and work with the schools to address these issues that affect girls and boys, particularly that beyond the school, they still need for support. And we also need to go back to our advocacy and advocate for education policy and legislation, because protecting girls' rights is not just about raising awareness. We need to put in legislative measures that will be able to protect the girls' rights. Now, what do we measure? Other than so far we've been measuring the increase in the level of sexual and reproductive health, but I think that is not enough. If we are going to link HIV/AIDS to gender, we need to look at reduction in school girl pregnancies, especially that this has a lot to do with the maternal mortality rates and also the child mortality rates. Once we reduce schoolgirl pregnancies, we are going to see, I know that is attributive, but I'm sure we are going to see a reduction in maternal mortality rates. Long term, there is need to reduce the gender parity index. Thank you.
Thanks, Emily. So, thank you very much, Daphne. That was great. A nice warm-up for talking about Zambia. And thanks to CSIS and Janet and Lisa for leading us to this conference today. I'm going to be talking about operationalizing HIV prevention education in schools, this example of Changes 2, which was often called wraparound through PEPFAR, application of funds in the education sector. I would like to ask you, given conversations last night and again today, I'd like to ask you to start thinking, as I go through this, of the impact that education sector can make on scale-up regarding linkages with HIV/AIDS prevention, mitigation, sustainability, and the sustainability of such linkages, bringing HIV/AIDS technical specialists into the education sector, and then also helping to build systems for design and monitoring of HIV education prevention activities. Those are going to be themes that you'll see throughout this discussion that I will we'll talk more about during questions, but I think if you're thinking about them as I go through, it'll help. Always in talking about HIV and AIDS in education, in my work here in Washington through USAID and also, again, on the Changes 2 program and at AIR, one has to give the rationale for why do this in schools at all. The health sector is constantly reminding us how ineffective schools are for delivering HIV prevention education. Well, there's the new technical guidance on sexuality education out of UNESCO that was published last year, which gives great evidence for the effectiveness of programs in education changing behaviors that are relevant for HIV/AIDS reduction, HIV/AIDS rates, transmission rates being reduced among youth. And I want to highlight specifically their review results that point to at least a third of the programs that were reviewed leading to reduced misinformation, increased correct information around HIV and AIDS, clarification and strengthening positive values and attitudes, increasing skills to make informed decisions and act on them, improving perceptions about peer groups and social norms, delay of sexual debut, reduction in frequency of partners, reduction in the number of sexual partners. Those are all accomplishments of prevention education programs for kids in school as well as out of school. And UNESCO and UNAIDS both make a very strong case of assembling the evidence and reviewing studies that document all of that. So if we think about those benefits of prevention education generally combined with the issues around scalability, scale up, the scale that one can attain by working with the education sector, as well as the sustainability, something that Robert Clay asked last evening, if that wasn't something that was really critical to emphasize with the education sector. By working through the education sector, there are a few key things that we'll see over and over in the presentation around... Sorry Janet. I thought you said something to me, Janet. Sorry. Bringing HIV/AIDS technical specialists into the education sector, which is something we all would condone for ensuring the best quality HIV prevention curricula in schools. Systematizing these prevention activities within ministries of education, especially through teacher professional development. And then building systems to measure the effectiveness of them. The Changes 2 program itself, it was a four-and-a-half-year cooperative agreement funded by USAID, through the EQIP 1 program, so it was a mainstream education sector program. This was not a health program working in education. It was an education program working with the Ministry of Education long-term. Changes 2 actually means, let's see if I get this right, Community Health and Nutrition, Gender and Education Support 2. Education Support 1, the first version, was building a school health system in the Ministry of Education. It studied the impact of HIV/AIDS on education, but it did not attempt to do prevention education or any of the activities that we're talking about here. It built a foundation for addressing health in education generally. Changes 2 operated in five provincial offices across Zambia, 55 field-based staff. Its partners, of course, as we've heard from Daphne, one major partner was FOESA, the Copper Belt Health Education Project, and also the Family Health Trust. They were all key partners for scholarship administration, but also on small grants targeting orphans and vulnerable children through PEPFAR resources. The main objectives of the program were strengthening HIV/AIDS prevention education, the outreach to communities using schools as community outreach centers for HIV prevention, sensitization among communities, and then within the context of improving the quality of basic education generally. A bulk of the funding, as I think this is my next slide, shows that actually Changes 2 was designed from its inception to accommodate multiple funding streams, and a large portion or the majority of its resources came from the education sector or from DA funds, Africa Education Initiative, Development Assistance, DA, for those who aren't familiar. The AEI, Africa Education Initiative, had its own OVC, Orphans and Vulnerable Children, wraparound funds, Fast Track Initiative that came straight from Congress, and economic support funds that came from the State Department. That allowed for the support to the education sector in a very broad way, supporting its ongoing reform program. The HIV/AIDS teacher training orphan and vulnerable children support, for staying in school, those were within the context of an ongoing reform. And everything that was it was engendering goodwill within the education sector to bring those HIV resources to education rather than having a health sector activity come over. We heard about the difficulties that sometimes health sector projects or even PEPFAR-funded activities have getting into the Ministry of Education. Schools are overwhelmed. If you're not improving the quality of pedagogy and helping build a teacher training system, people don't have a whole lot of time to talk to you. The school level impacts, however, by working through an ongoing systems reform in education are quite astounding. 2 million kids were reached with prevention education. And while the curriculum that Daphne was talking about needs to be harmonized, teachers could be trained, in fact, and do their own professional development long-term in a way that allows them to be better teachers of what curriculum exists. You can't wait until the curriculum in every country is finalized before you actually start training teachers. And that's what this project was primarily doing, was building a system for long-term training of teachers. So you have 13,000 teachers trained. 2,000 schools were affected by this improved training. It also built resource centers at all the schools, which were critical in playing a role in this community-level outreach. So you had community members that were specifically targeted through PEPFAR funding for HIV prevention education within their communities, mobilizing, designing action plans, and putting them into place, many of them that were supporting orphans and vulnerable children and HIV-affected people in the community. We've heard already about the OVC support scholarships that FAWESA was a key partner in implementing. That was a massive influx of resources to education to keep vulnerable kids in school and avoid the tragedy of them falling out of school for lack of resources in HIV-affected households. There were small grants also awarded through the program that provided schools and communities a mechanism to help support systemically orphans and vulnerable children through feeding schemes at schools, clothing. There were a number of different psychosocial outreach activities as well. And through the grant systems for these community-level and school-level grants, 356,000 orphans and vulnerable children were reached. Now, the question exists. It's a big question. What do you monitor in education systems to be able to demonstrate the effectiveness of a school HIV/AIDS prevention program? And I'm the co-chair now of the IATT, the Interagency Task Team on HIV/AIDS in Education, which is mandated by UNAIDS through UNESCO to lead the education sector globally in its response to HIV and AIDS. Well, through ministries of education like Zambia, saying we don't know what we should be monitoring. We need help. It can't just be every project driving its own agenda. We want to put into our education management information system a series of simple indicators that can be part of our ongoing EMIS program so that this data would, that's the ideal, the data would be collected by the ministry on an annual basis and reported in the education statistics bulletin annually. So the interagency task team, working with ministries, asked the question, what are the core indicators that could do that but would demonstrate significant behavior change to the health sector, to our HIV/AIDS partners such as PEPFAR, so that resources could continue to flow to build and strengthen HIV prevention programs in schools? And this is the, after a very lengthy consultative process, these indicators are in this latest version of the manual. There are 6 core ones that ministries, health sector professionals, they're being field tested at this time. And as you can see, they relate largely to what education systems can do, what they are designed to do, educate, change cognitive behaviors at school, but also still have significant impact on HIV/AIDS transmission rates. And they're targeting specifically being able to demonstrate changes in risky behaviors among youth and school-age youth. And we're talking about an age category here where there are ethical and legal issues involved with collecting data around sexual practices, anyone under the age of consent. So I'm very happy to share the manual with folks if you'd like to see it. And I think my time is up. Special thanks, of course, to PEPFAR and AID. I think it's very important to note that doing these programs really does require a champion at the mission level, at the country level, who's looking for the opportunity to do this in education rather than looking for why you shouldn't do it. Under the previous PEPFAR guidance, there was a lot of technical guidance on what you can't spend PEPFAR resources on. Marta Levitt-Dial was the PEPFAR champion in USAID Zambia, who actively looked for the opportunities to spend PEPFAR resources, things that could be accounted for and answer responsibly to PEPFAR for reaching its impacts. But they were significant to education, and the education sector grabbed them up, both at the ministerial level and the COP, and our technical specialist, Joan Woods, the DCOP in the field, who was the HIV/AIDS specialist. And thanks very much.
So we're going to try to keep on schedule here, the last presentation for about 15 minutes, and then questions 15 minutes, and go to the next panel.
Thank you very much, Jean. I'm coming in third. It's also wonderful presentations from Daphne and Brad. But I want you to hang on to some keywords they have used, which I'll use in my presentation, and that is, of course, integration, but they use the word wraparounds. And issues of school pregnancy and also home-based care. These are some of the things that I would talk during my presentation. So we're going to take a drive, or is it a flight, from Zambia to Kenya. It's not very far. And share with you experiences that we have undergone in Kenya with respect to reproductive health and HIV integration. I'll particularly make reference to a project which is a bilateral. It's called the AIDS Population Health Integrated Assistance, which is basically a PEPFAR-funded program or project. FHI takes a lead in two specific regions in the country, Kenya, and I would like to draw experiences from that. Basically, I'll take you through the rationale why there should be integration between RH and HIV, down to the actual funding mechanism in this particular project, leading you through the outcomes, some challenges, and some policy implications with respect to PEPFAR and recommendations. So why integrate? That's the reason. Why? That's the question. Why integrate between reproductive health and HIV? Quite a couple of reasons, really. But the basic one is that they share common concerns. They are both sexually active. Clients who go to the HIV sites, service sites, and also to the reproductive health sites, they really share the same concerns. And for example, a client who goes to the family planning clinic would like, on in above, to know the timing and spacing of pregnancy. They will also want to know their status. They want to know their status so they can know how to behave or conduct themselves, whether they're HIV positive or whether they're HIV negative. Similarly, clients who go to the HIV service sites, they also bring upon with them some needs. They may have a very high unmet need for family planning, or maybe they also, with this association between HIV and cancer of the cervix, they will also want to have screening services for cancer of the cervix, because there's no point in them to do very well on ARVs, only to succumb to cancer of the cervix, which they would have actually prevented. So I share with you some evidence in Kenya, where in the Kenya AIDS Indicator Survey of 2007, it indicated that clients who go to the HIV care and treatment centers, they do have a very high, unmet family planning needs of about 60%. That means, therefore, these needs need to be met. The benefit of family planning, especially for those who are HIV positive, is basically to enable the HIV-positive female clients to decide whether they really, what number of children they have, and also spacing of their children. It also reduces unintended pregnancies and therefore unsafe abortions, for that matter. And we know the connection between family planning and maternal and infant health. There is obviously a major connection of reducing mother-to-child transmission of HIV virus through the second pillar of the PMTCT package, which is nothing but really family planning, reduction of unintended pregnancy. So let me take you through the history of integration in this country, Kenya. It's actually a decade now. It started off rather, initially at the year 2000 with connecting the counseling and testing piece into the PMTCT. But structurally and systematically, it actually started in 2001, where the concerns was to integrate family planning into VCT. At that time, the VCTs were really coming up. And there were major concerns. Is it feasible? Is it acceptable? And assessments were done, and it showed that totally feasible and acceptable. And the country took that up and came up with a strategy, which was of how to integrate family planning and HIV. And then from then on, several models came out, types of integration, between counseling and testing and family planning, or even family planning in the care and treatment centers. Indicators were developed to also try and measure this integration mechanism, and all these were being done and led by the Ministry of Health of that country. And finally, now culminating to all that effort, there is a whole strategy which is just about to be launched end of this month by the ministry, and that is the Reproductive Health and HIV Integration Strategy. Now, how about this project that I mentioned, the AFIA project, the AIDS Population Health Integrated Assistance. It's an integrated package, but it's predominantly an HIV program funded. If give an example of one of the projects that we take a lead on, that's the COST AFIA, 93% of these funds are actually for HIV programming, and only 7% is for family planning and maternal and child health. Yet, this happens in an environment of huge needs with respect to reproductive health, high maternal mortality rates, low CPR, and a very high unmet family planning need. Now, the PEPFAR resources were actually directed to strengthen the infrastructure, the health system, and the capacity for HIV services. But in so doing, it was an easy way of actually wrapping around the reproductive health services to actually leverage from the system that have been established by the HIV funds to start providing reproductive health services. And this is basically what represents the essence of the wraparound in this particular project, which lended its effort towards providing reproductive health services, including family planning, in a predominantly HIV programming system. Now, what about the types of integration? These are the various types, as you can see, both being provided in this project sites, and they are bi-directional in many aspects. And you can see that it ranges from care and treatment centers to youth-friendly services to cervical cancer screening, post-rep care, etc. It's at all level, even up to the community level, where the home-based care is integrated with family planning. The type of the mode of delivery of these particular services is basically on-site, on the side there. On-site means the one-stop shop, which has been mentioned. Mixed is a portion of both, and then a referral component. And finally, the referral type, where a full referral mechanism is put into place. Now, these two slides that I'm showing you here are basically to represent the number of service sites that are being provided by type of integration, and also the number of service providers who are being trained in this particular aspect. A point to note is the cervical cancer screening, which is just kicking in, and it's growing. Now, what about the effect of all this? I just showed this graph to just indicate with respect to family planning consultation or attendances that took place last year, one third of all the total family planning clients, as you can see, are attributed to actually integration sites. In other words, 30%, approximately 30% of the clients who are seen, who are provided family planning services, really got it from the integration sites, which means that they really were able to access the other service that they obtained, a service which probably they would not have had or obtained if it were not for integration. And this is another example of the effect of integration it has on uptake of family planning methods. This is a study which was conducted in 2008 and over 2009, and it followed up clients who were attending the care and treatment centers, and the intervention package was to actually integrate family planning into the care and treatment centers. And with that follow-up after 10 months, it resulted in a significant increase in the uptake of modern methods among the female clients, 36% up to 50%, and this was statistically significant. So these are the challenges that we're seeing, basically inadequate funding, positive policy environment versus inadequate funding. The policy environment is there. Translating the policy environment to sufficient funding is the challenge. Direct funding for integration services is also something that has not really been effected properly, and the issue of advocacy, ownership, human resource shortages, infrastructure problem, and commodity insecurity still exists. Data capture is something that has been with us for some time, although there are good news now that some indicators have now been factored in the HIV program, HMIS, and this including the family planning indicator in the postnatal clinic registers, and also now family planning, STI, and cancer of the cervix being included in the comprehensive care set of indicators. The translation of this into the data collection tools is ongoing. So what are the lessons learned so far? That truly reproductive health HIV integration is feasible, and that different types, it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. It's that different sites or different types of integration work best in different regions. The on-site mode of delivery is actually popular, and that's a one-stop shop. Advocacy and supervision is essential. And field experiences lead to evidence-based decision-making in the sense that the examples where the HMIS department wanted to know what is experienced out there in terms of integration for them to include the indicators. And once they got the experiences from the field, they were ready to insert or include them in their national HMIS system. We believe that the Rift and the Coast Province experience is worthwhile to exist as a learning model for integration. This is my second last slide. So what's the implication for PEPFAR policy? One is that FP services contribute directly to PEPFAR prevention goals, without doubt. It is possible for our HIV program to integrate family planning into RH services. Reproductive health HIV integration has the potential to enhance the public health impact of services and better meet the needs of the client, as we have shown earlier. And that funding for integration programming and research still remains inadequate. So what are the recommendations? That PEPFAR should emphasize reproductive health and HIV integration of services at all levels, in all policies, and also at the field level. Support countries to adopt wraparounds using integration or linkages of services. Consider direct funding for reproductive health HIV integration, and consider specific funding for allocation for contraceptive commodities procurement, particularly with reference to the HIV program sites. Develop reproductive health related targets and indicators for reporting, and then finally allocate public health evaluation funding for research to expand the evidence of reproductive health HIV integration best practices. So this is the acknowledgement. I acknowledge the director of FHI in Kenya, country director, the FHI Contraceptive Reproductive Technology and Utilization Team, CRTU, both in North Carolina and also in Nairobi. and then the AFIA team and the Ministry of Health, the HIV program and the Reproductive Health Department in the Ministry of Health, USAID Kenya, and service providers and clients. So I thank you.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. Why don't we take three questions and...
Hi, yes, Lorette Kakuza from SEDPA. Thank you all for wonderful presentations. Dr. Solomon, I wonder if I can direct a question to you with regard to your recommendation, and perhaps others in the room could answer this better than you, but with regard to the recommendation that all policies and guidelines for PEPFAR include integration. I know that that was the intent and that there is some in the guidance, but where we have not seen it is in the compact, and I wonder if anybody can speak to how we can ensure that integration language gets into the country compacts.
Next question.
Sicardi from CSAS, also for Dr. Martson. I was struck by the funding proportions in the AFIA wraparound project, which I think you said was 93% HIV funding and 7% family planning RH funding. So I'm just wondering if you could expand a little bit on how you were able to do probably some of the retraining and expansion of services and other types of things that would need to be maybe retooled a bit in order to really fully integrate the family planning services into the HIV services with that really limited pot of funding, and what some of the practical challenges were in accomplishing that.
And is there a third question, or should we? Okay.
Katrin Bow, CSIS. I'm curious what the challenges that you find to your integration efforts that lack of access to water and sanitation present, and also opportunities for expanding access to water and sanitation, how that would complement your work. Thank you.
Okay. I think a couple of them were directed at you, but one was a general one, I think, about the partnership frameworks or the, and as well as the funding disparity, I guess.
The first question, you basically wanted to know how it can be, the policies can be shifted into countries' context. Am I correct? Partnership or context?
Yes. Oh, I misspoke. It is the partnership frameworks that I'm talking about. The agreements between the country and...
So there's the five-year one and the one-year one.
Right.
So just those...
Okay. Maybe others could come in there. But my response to that is that the country's policy documents have to be in tandem with what is being proposed as or the push towards linkages. And I think PEPFAR does articulate some aspect the need to have the linkages. Now it is upon the countries also to actually have their policy or strategic plans to actually articulate the same. And then that now will provide a good fit and be able to translate what is being stated into what is called programming. So if I can just use the example of Kenya, that surely is not going to be a problem because the policy environment is there in terms of the strategic plans, the policy documents. They're all indicating that they would wish to have an integrated package across the service delivery units. It doesn't mean reproductive health and HIV only, but also on other particular services, including tuberculosis, malaria, etc., child health, immunization services. So my response to that is that with the over global guidance, it will work better if the countries themselves have documents and strategies that go in line with that. And I think many countries have appreciated the need to have an integrated package and also linkages across sectors, so that we'll be able to leverage on and have that extra mileage that it brings on board. Now, the second one was about limitation. Thank you, Lisa, for that question. Yes, how did we go about this? I think the one I made reference to is called AFIA COST. It's actually the AFIA project, which is particularly funds the COST province of that country, that is Kenya. And it's actually 93% versus 7%. So how did we go about leveraging on this to be able to expand or increase access to reproductive health services? One important thing is that there are some related activities. Let's say, for example, if you are training on post-exposure prophylaxis, then in this particular case, it was easy for them to include emergency contraception and bring in the whole aspect of comprehensive post-rape care services into it. So the training will be one, but the effect is on both sides. And that's how they were able to leverage. The training on PMTCT is not just on the HIV part, but prevention of mother-to-child transmission also has a reproductive health component. It has a component on obstetric care, and also it has a component on family planning. So it was such particular strategies or approaches that were used to capitalize or maximize the opportunity that existed through the predominant HIV program. But the other thing which I wanted to say was that the strengthening of the infrastructure and the motivation of the staff or the service providers using HIV funds, because that's what was there in plenty, was the one that was made it easy for the reproductive health services to be provided. So it was easy to wrap around a strong component, which is the HIV service site, and then add on top of it reproductive health services. So that's how this project went around to support a fairly underfunded reproductive health side of things using the very strong HIV program that existed at that point in time. Yeah.
And do either of you want to answer the other question around other challenges? No.
I would simply say that water and sanitation, I think that was the specific question that she was asking, and it certainly is a very big problem for schools. And it's one of the biggest hindrances, especially to girls staying in school, is domestic labor and often carrying water in rural Africa, at least, is a really major issue. So provision of water and adequate sanitation in the school environment is something that ministries have worked very hard to find resources to accommodate, to make sure that there is adequate water and sanitation. And I have to say that actually an integrated approach to HIV/AIDS and school health and nutrition would go a long ways towards resolving some of that, because the school health and nutrition offices that have been left without resources while everyone flocked over to set up new HIV/AIDS offices have left school health programs often empty of resources.
Looking at Janet to see if she wants to take any more, or... We could take one more round. I know that our next panel is actually here, so we'll just take one more round. One, maybe two more questions.
Hi, I'm Nomi. Sorry, Nomi Fuchs Montgomery with Mary Stopes International. But I was previously with PEPFAR, so I'm going to sort of, this is coming out of my last job a bit, to think that the AFIA project, which was a really incredible project designed by USAID funded under the last administration really helped to achieve and advance a lot of the movement on integration that was supported under the previous administration. So if I could push sort of all of the panels moving forward from the really inspiring remarks from Ambassador Goosby this morning to think sort of how can we catalyze these past investments to take it further in terms of the goals that he identified this morning. We've already got some of these platforms, but what can you drill down a little bit more concretely about what can now happen with this new administration and some of, again, some of the sort of points that Ambassador Goosby outlined this morning about carrying the integration forward? Thank you.
Is there one last question over here?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'd really like to thank the panel for yet again a very informative session. To Solomon, I really appreciate your set of recommendations to PAPFA. You know, you listed things that could be done in terms of support to integration, support to linkages, and certainly that resonates in that in these settings when you have the woman who makes the effort to come to a family planning clinic. That is a testimony to the fact that she is sexually active. She would like to be protected against an unwanted pregnancy and certainly also an unintended infection. And at times she goes back without anyone having discussed with her the opportunity for that protection. The only challenge tends to be that many of the services we have, which is good, these are maternal family planning services. How do we bring in the male partner within this integration linkage equation? What has been your experience? Thank you.
So there's two last questions. One is about catalyzing the past investments and going even further, and the other is bringing in male partners.
Yeah, thanks a lot for those two questions. My only take on the issue of how do we move forward in terms of scale up is to be able to distill out of the many forms of integration, because it sounds nice on paper that we can integrate more or less everything to everything else. But I think it's time for us to be fairly strategic and define what are the most cost-effective ways of types of integration that has a high impact, and therefore have those are the ones that we would need to scale up, and so that we can be able to get, as somebody was saying, a bang for the buck. So that's how I take it when it comes to defining how do we move forward. The other thing, yes, and then the question from Mike, thanks a lot for that question. The male factor is still a problem. Of course, it cuts across in terms of ensuring that the male is engaged to stimulate and actually ensure there is increased uptake and utilization, not only by themselves, but also by their spouses, the female spouse, that is, and obviously there should be innovative efforts and strategies that needs to be placed so as to engage the men in such a way that they will actually provide the environment for an increased utilization or uptake of services. So I do agree that is something that we need to work on, and the experience that that we have back in Kenya is that that using a multimedia approach or multiple approaches to reach out for men does give rise to a positive uptake of services, be it on the side of the HIV uptake of services or even for reproductive health and other services. So it's an important component and should not be left off. When we're looking at ways of increasing uptake of services in any setting. Thank you.
Does anyone else want to comment from the panel?
I was going to comment on the how do we scale up or keep the momentum going from here. I think from the perspective of education, and I think it's also true from the legislative writing on women's empowerment issues, it's great to have it in the legislation, but that's not technical guidance. And for education, there was nothing to encourage anyone to look at another sector for education. And I don't recall seeing any technical guidance in the previous authorization of PEPFAR that encouraged that, or in OGAC previously. I would think that would be a key factor for anyone working in education to for PEPFAR, OGAC, GHI, give concrete technical guidance encouraging work in other sectors, in women's empowerment, education, with clear examples of what that means, what has been done successfully. Another thing that really is lacking from the perspective of education, and I think it's clear it's also lacking in women's empowerment, are best lessons and examples. And in the health sector and in HIV and AIDS, the Synergies Project and others collected examples of really good practices that should be replicated. Nothing exists like that for multi-sectoral work for the most part, certainly not for education. So any resources that can be put to that end is doing an immense service towards building these linkages, giving a common set of things to measure. It would be a very, very significant step in that direction.
I actually think that's an excellent place to end and segue to our next panel, which I think we're going to get at a lot of the issues that just came up around catalyzing on past investments and what guidance is being made available, et cetera. So why don't everyone join me and thank our panelists. We'll do the quick switch.